This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Reason.
Right. I see Jane's father certainly as less of a father and more of a friend, but not really even a friend. He's more of just kind of a philosopher. And he has his views, he has his beliefs, and he speaks about them and spouts them out whether anybody's listening or not. And she, being, you know, his daughter, I guess absorbed a lot of what he said and a lot of what he believed, and it really impacted her whether he was actually parenting her or not. So it's sort of passive parenting that he ended up doing with her.
You chose to tell the story with Jane having gone through therapy, mm-hmm. In a retrospective voice. So she's processed some of these experiences, mm-hmm. and has some commentary on it. Did you choose that as a means to enhance this sense of her as sort of prematurely an adult, even when she is a child? Because she feels, even in the child time, to uh-huh. be someone who's taken on the responsibility of an adult.
Right. Well, I wanted her to be precocious, and I wanted her to, like her father, have developed a belief system about the social world around her. I kind of see her as incredibly detached from the rest of humanity in a lot of ways, and maybe that's because she was raised in an isolated way with her father, where they were each other's only friends, you know? And maybe it's just because of what happened to her, or maybe it's a combination of both. But I really think of her more as somebody who observes rather than experiences.
So it's interesting how, as the book progresses, Jane becomes more active and responsible for figuring out what to do as her father sort of regresses and mm-hmm. he becomes more infantilized in mm-hmm. the sense that he's even sending her drawings rather than letters mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. the insane asylum. So we have this crossing where he's becoming more like a child and she's trying to grapple with her situation without mm-hmm. without responsible parenting.
Well, the funny thing is it's sort of the same thing that really anybody goes through if they're lucky enough to have their parents, you know, survive into old age. Your parents will, no matter what, kind of deteriorate and become more childlike if they make it that long, and you will, as their child, become the adult in the situation and become the caretaker, and it just kind of happened at a very early age for Jane in a weird way.
Given that you're a psychologist, do you have any particular thoughts about kids who are forced to parent their parents? Because even in the first page, Jane is saying, I wish I could have been there for my dad when he lost his mom. Mm-hmm. Like her thoughts are very much that of a caretaker mm-hmm. before he's even left as a father. And I'm curious about what way that would color her mm-hmm. narration of the story.
Gosh, well, I'm not a parent myself, so I don't know if I have any, I don't know if I have any relevant commentary on whether it's appropriate or inappropriate, what the best parenting style is, you know, but I do think that I guess that my opinion, without being a parent on it, is that a parent should be parenting their children and not the other way around. I think that a child who grows up and then can look back in retrospect and say, gosh, I wish I would have been able to help my parents, is a child who's been parented well because they still love their parents and wish that they could have done something in retrospect to make their parents happier, right? So I actually think it's a testament to Jane's father that she's thinking that she has this love for him and doesn't harbor, you know, this sort of resentment that so many people have for their parents.
Well, tell us what the title Stupid Children means to you.
I think that, you know, kids, just by definition, they haven't lived long enough to know what's going on. They need the experience of the adults around them. And so they don't know. They don't know anything. And so they follow the adults. And there's a certain age at which kids, you know, during which kids break out of the adults know everything and I know nothing phase. And they start to realize that adults are also just people who are limited in terms of knowledge and awareness. And this is a kid who believed that her father knew everything and was right about everything, and then she's sent off to be with different adults who believe they know everything and are right about everything, and all of a sudden she's faced with having to realize that nobody knows anything and everybody's wrong about everything and nobody knows that they're wrong. And it's just kind of a, I guess stupid children refers to all the people who don't realize that they don't know anything and they're so arrogant that they're not willing to admit it.
And there's that funny scene in the book between several kids in the cult about whether a child can be stupid. And obviously Jane thinks that they can, and others think that it's impossible for a child to be stupid. Mm-hmm. Do you think she sees being childlike as being weak and therefore stupid?
I think she definitely thinks being childlike is the same thing as weakness. And I don't know if she thinks that weakness is stupidity. I don't think she does at that time. I think later she comes to believe that weakness is synonymous with stupidity because look where it got her. Well, I don't know if she would call it weakness. I guess that makes me wonder if weakness is the same thing as dependence in this question. I think she thinks it's a beneficial characteristic to be able to be dependent upon another person because she was dependent on her father for a number of years and it went very well during those years. But I think she later comes to believe that weakness and dependence are synonymous, and that's what gets her into trouble, and that's when she starts to think that dependence is stupidity or weak or whatever you might want to call it. Yeah.
I absolutely love the cover of this book.
And I do too.
Did you have any say in choosing it?
It's an interesting story, actually. When I was in college, I had a subscription to The New Yorker, and I was flipping through it in my dorm or wherever I was, and the picture on the cover was in The New Yorker, I guess in a story about a gallery that was showing Inger Krause's photography for some show coming up. And I was just immediately drawn in by this picture, and I just loved it. And I cut it out of The New Yorker and like taped it to this piece of white cardboard and put it on my wall. And I'd say I'm gonna get this photograph one day when I make a success of myself. I'm gonna get this photograph. And I told this story to Brian, to my publisher, and he got a hold of the photographer of Inger Krause. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, by the way. But he got a hold of this photographer and got the rights for the photograph for the cover of my book. It was a really nice gift.
And it feels like it resonates very much with sort of the uneasiness and innocence at the same time that is going on in Stupid Children.
I agree.
I was looking up Ingar Krause, and there was a description of his work that I felt like was a really interesting description. I thought of possibly of Jane, your protagonist, too. It said, his young subjects seem to have knowledge and wisdom beyond their years. Despite the mask-like appearance, each tries to project. Their eyes, faces, and postures reveal confusion, frustration, melancholy. They are serious, remote, sad, defiant. They've already seen too much, and the innocence lost is painfully etched in each of these images. It felt very much like...
Yeah, that I've never heard that before. I think that it sounds a hell of a lot like Jane, yeah.
So in case you just tuned in, we're talking to Lenore Zion about her first novel, Stupid Children, published by Emergency Press. So in your day job, you're a psychologist, and you specialize in sexual pathologies.
That's right.
And I felt like there was a really interesting choice you made in Stupid Children that I'm curious about. And one of the, it felt like sexual abuse loomed over the book, though often it was never happening. For instance, I thought of the father, when Jane was still living with her father, he would wake her up in the middle of the night. And there was this sense of foreboding for me as the reader that he was going to go into the bedroom and molest her. And yet he's just waking her up for the most innocent of reasons to go and have a midnight breakfast.
Right.
And then similarly, there's a cleansing ritual with her foster parents where she gets these balloons inflated in her nostrils that break her nose. But she's brought back into this black room. And again, the first thing that leaps to my mind is that as a reader is they're going to do something horrible to her sexually because this is happening to her during puberty as well. So was that an intentional dynamic to, to have the foreboding but not the actual realization?
Yes, it was intentional. The most important thing for me when I was writing this book was to be writing it with an authentic voice. So I wanted it to sound the way that it sounds when a person goes into a therapy session. You know, this is her account of her life, and there are things that she's going to dance around and not really say, you know, flat out, not be direct about. And there are things that she's going to be direct about and kind of matter of fact and distanced and kind of cold about events in her life. She's also constantly explaining things away and using the intellectualization defense and not really emotionally connecting with the events that occurred in her own life. And that was the most important thing for me. So the sense of foreboding, I think, is just kind of the unconscious, it's Jane's unconscious coming through in her telling of her story. It's the fact that you can't ignore the darkness that she's been through, and she can't intellectualize it away. It's there whether she says it directly or not.
So does that mean that she's not entirely a reliable narrator in the sense that maybe some abuse happened and she can't face it and therefore can't tell us?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. Yeah.
Interesting. She also says that in her own therapeutic process that she's diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love, since you are a psychologist, for you to tell us what that means as we listen to her narration. Like, what does that mean for us as the reader that she's telling us a diagnosis that she may grasp or not?
Right. That was sort of actually just an inside joke that I threw in for my psychologist friends, because narcissistic personality disorder kind of describes everybody in the world. And so I don't think Jane is a narcissist, but when you're talking about legitimate narcissistic personality disorder, you're talking about somebody who very deep at their core has a profound fear of inadequacy and of people pointing out these inadequacies. So they defend by making themselves superior. I think that Jane doesn't feel superior. She feels confused when people aren't doing the things that she sees as obvious and making the choices that she believes to be the right choices. And she just doesn't understand when people make bad decisions. It drives her crazy. I don't think it's narcissistic, though.
Well, definitely having the foreboding of the potential sexual abuse, which now I'm learning could actually have been real sexual abuse. There's also another way you created a sense of uncanniness over and above the craziness of the cult itself. It was the use of animals. And I'm interested in whether that came out sort of happenstance as you wrote or whether it was something planned. You have the mounted heads on the wall, you have the hedgehog story, you have these porcelain geese, and all of that adds a sort of weirdness to the narrative that you still feel like you're in a recognizable world, but it has sort of a David Lynchian effect, I think, in the writing.
Oh, that's really flattering. I'll take that. I like it. I guess that's just the kind of scenery that I find interesting. I wouldn't find it particularly interesting to read about Jane in a normal house that doesn't have, you know, heads all over the walls. And I don't know. I guess judging by my first book, My Dead Pets Are Interesting, I like for there to be a lot of dead animals around. What can I say? I find them fascinating.
I listened to an early a podcast that you're in. I think it was a Nervous Breakdown podcast from several years ago. And you read a piece about how sexual pathology was pretty determined. The norms of sexual behavior was determined by pretty much by culture. So there's a lot of arbitrariness to the way that different sexual behaviors were defined.
Yeah.
Do you think that's also true when it comes to religions? Here we have her thrown into a cult. The cult has all sorts of rituals which are not recognizable in any of the established religions. Is what makes this cult pathological versus just a weird religion?
Well, I would say what's pathological about it is that it consists of adults who prey on children, and that's all that they do. They gather children, whether it be by foster care or, you know, by birthing them into the system, and they abuse them. That's what they do. And they try unsuccessfully really to It's really an unsuccessful cult. They try unsuccessfully to indoctrinate children, and it never works, which is why they keep having these suicides and the kind of attrition rate of you know, children in the cult is huge. So it's about this kind of cult of loser adults who can't even get their cult off the ground, I guess. I certainly don't know if it's comparable to any religion. I don't think that I would say that it is. I'm not a particularly religious person myself, but I think most religions that you've heard of are a bit more successful than the Second Day Believers.
And what do you make of the fact that Jane is a secular Jew in this story, mm-hmm. and she finds herself in a manger in a very bizarre ritual for the Second Day Believers as sort of the Jesus character? So what a dynamic were you exploring there?
Well, you know, that scene is actually where I started with this whole book. That's where I started writing. And I think that, I mean, I didn't know what I was writing when I started writing that. And I just really liked the idea of a girl waking up and finding herself having been forcefully placed in a manger as the Jesus character and not let out. I didn't really know what I was getting at when I was writing it, but as I continued to write the book and the story kind of formed around it, I thought, well, this is sort of perfect. You know, there's this unsuccessful cult that they don't really know how to get their cult off the ground. You know, people aren't really buying into it. And they kind of try to imprison people and force them to believe it. And the way that they do this is by, you know, kind of creating this surreal environment that makes nods to other religions. And not that I want to call, you know, Christianity a cult or anything, I don't, but, you know, it's one successful religion that they're making a nod to in order to kind of get their cult off the ground, I guess. They just can't do it. anybody who has to imprison somebody in order to get them to start seeing things their way is not very convincing, right?
Yeah, and how do you find your job as a psychologist informing your work? And there's the obvious ways. I mean, we start out right away with the dad with a grief counselor and mm-hmm. and the narrator talking about her therapy also. But mm-hmm. are there other ways in which you find that this cross-fertilization between psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of my characters, I chose backgrounds for them that would cause them to have the personalities and the behaviors that they have. You know, I was very careful about that to make sure that these were people who had been led to where they were. And I think that my background in psychology really helped with that. I read a lot of times when I read books, I think this person wouldn't be like this. This character wouldn't have this reaction. This character wouldn't believe the things that he or she believes. And I think that it's just kind of the writer's not necessarily knowing the way that the human mind works when it's pushed up against something that the story is referencing.
So what influences do you have from the literary side? You mentioned that the books that you read that you don't believe, mm-hmm. are there certain ones that you've gone to for either style or structure cues or just overall vibe that you you pay homage to?
Yeah, not really. I think I might be unusual in that regard. I certainly have writers who I admire and think are really brilliant, but I don't think that for a second I could write like they do. So I don't even try. I'm not, you know, I don't want to be influenced by them too much because it's like if I started painting and said I'm going to be like Picasso, you know, I don't particularly want to stand next to that and be judged. So I tried to come from a new place really when I was writing this and not be influenced by any other writers. But I guess in terms of theme and content, I'm influenced mostly by psych books. You know, Psychopathia Sexualis is the most influential book in history for me. That's a really big deal for me. And
Who is that by?
It's not fiction. It's a collection of case studies by Richard von Kraft Ebing. It was written in 1886, and he was a psychiatrist. He just collected a whole bunch of case studies on people with deviant sexuality. And of course, the deviant sexuality at the time was not necessarily what's considered deviant now, but a lot of it really is still. You know, there's a lot of necrophilia and things like this. And, you know, I read this when I was young, and it certainly has influenced me in a number of ways. But in terms of pathology and in terms of what the human mind can do based on sexual aggression, that definitely influenced my book. I would say probably my biggest influence for theme is Catherine Dunn with Geek Love. You know, I also read that when I was fairly young, and I remember just being she knocked me off my feet. I'd read a lot by that point, but I'd never read somebody who is so wonderfully repulsive in her writing. All of her characters are stomach-turning and horrifying, and you love them and want to be with them and hang out with them, and she's just a genius. She's really brilliant. And so I'd say content, she definitely paved the way for me to say, okay, I can write about the freakiest things imaginable. I don't care what it looks like, because Catherine Dunn did it first. You know.
And it sounds like you're interested in going into more of those themes in future projects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, whatever I'm writing right now. I'm not sure what I'm writing. I know it's a novel, but the thing I'm writing right now is really, really weird.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I would, but, you know, I learned my lesson. I always change after I say something out loud. I end up having to delete that thing, and the story takes a completely different turn, and, sure, you know, it doesn't even end up being relevant. So,
well, speaking of that, you mentioned in an early podcast that you were writing a book called Victimology. Is that Stupid Children?
Yeah, that's Stupid Children. Victimology, though, again, Stupid Children wasn't, that book wasn't what I was writing in the beginning. I wrote for 2 years writing this thing that I was calling Victimology. And it was a completely different book. And for 2 years, I hated it, and I hated it, and I hated it, and I kept working on it compulsively. And eventually, I just, you know, got to a breaking point and threw it all out. I deleted it, except for about 20 pages, which were in that manger scene. And then I said, all right, I'm not going to put the pressure on myself to write a novel. I'm not going to think of it that way. And I went to work, and whenever clients would cancel, I would take my laptop out and I'd just write something without thinking. And then all of a sudden I realized that I was writing my book. And 2 months later, it was just done. It was done like that. And then I cleaned it up and made a lot of edits and everything. But I didn't even think about it. It's a completely different, the first book was like this slapstick thing. It was very different. I don't know what I was writing. Yeah.
So do you have a working title for your new one that you can tell us and then we can know to throw out later?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you the working title is Nice Parasites.
Oh, I like that.
Thanks. Thanks. It might change. Who knows? Depending on the publisher and my feelings at the time.
Well, we look forward to Nice Parasites. It was nice having you on Between the Covers today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking today with Lenore Zion about her debut novel, Stupid Children. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Blank Stares is a Portland, Oregon-based collective and electronic music label. They host a monthly all-ages sonic buffet called Beat Together. This month's Beat Together will take place the evening of May 31st at the Timeshare Gallery, Northwest Broadway in Portland, featuring Ali, B-Side, Meek Sneak, and Slow Sleeve Love. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Creative Music Guild's second annual Improvisation Summit, Friday, May 31st and Saturday, June 1st at Sandbox Studio. 2 days of exciting performances featuring local artists and William Hooker from New York City. Performers include Golden Retriever, Daniel Menchie, Battle Hymns and Gardens, 1939 Ensemble, and more. Also, there will be workshops, panel discussions, dance, as well as film performances presented by Cinema Project and Experimental Film Festival. The Creative Music Guild is a locally based nonprofit dedicated to presenting adventurous music from the worlds of jazz and experimental avant-garde since 1991. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org or ask at the information table when you attend the Improvisation Summit on May 31st and June 1st at the Sandbox Studio located at 420 Northeast 9th Avenue in Portland.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with author Jonathan Shoupy. Mr. Shoupy has written a book called A Chance to Win. It's a redemption story from the streets of Newark, New Jersey. Mr. Shoupy, thanks for talking with me. To start out, for people who haven't read your book, can you talk a little bit about what it's about?
Well, at its core, it's a story about a man who is seeking redemption, as the title suggests. It's a man who I met while I was a newspaper reporter in Newark, New Jersey. I was a crime reporter, and I came across him working on a story about gun violence victims. He was a former drug dealer who had been shot in a drive-by, left paralyzed from the waist down, and was in a deep depression, and I wrote about that situation. And then we got to know each other. And a few years later, he decided that he wanted to try to turn himself around and find more, new positive purpose in life. And he wanted to do that by coaching a baseball team, a Little League team, and he was a very unlikely coach, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the book tells the story about how he tries to build this team, and I also follow some of the kids he tries to coach as they grow up in a very unforgiving urban environment.
The man's name is Rodney Mason, and I'd like to talk about him for a few minutes, but I wanted to talk about your career first. You've spent much of your career in New Jersey doing a lot of government reporting, but in 2004 you became a criminal justice reporter with the New Jersey Star-Ledger. Did you get the idea for this book before that, or did you get the idea after you became a crime reporter?
The idea for the book came to me while I was a crime reporter in Newark. I had spent a lot of my career writing about public affairs, writing about government, covering politics. I had covered for several years the beat in the state capitol in Trenton. And then I decided that I wanted to leave the political realm and go into more of a urban, I guess you could call it, real life environment where I always could talk, do more stories about ordinary people, if you will. And so that manifested itself in doing some crime reporting in Newark. And that is where I met Rodney.
Okay.
And that relationship that I developed with him from that initial story that I wrote about gunshot victims developed into my following his inaugural season as a coach in early 2008. And I wrote a story about that, and that became the nugget of what ultimately was many more years of work on this book.
The reason I ask that is because you had won an award in 2002 for work you had done on gangs in New Jersey. So I didn't know if the idea for the book came after you worked as a criminal reporter or if the idea got planted in your head after the award you won for the gang reporting.
I had always had this desire to cover more with more nuance some of the stories that I had written in the past. One of those stories included a multi-day series that I did with a colleague of mine at the Ledger that looked into what at the time was the emergence in Newark and other cities in New Jersey of what we called Los Angeles-style street gangs. And so it was a story that looked at how some of these communities were starting to come under the influence of these new-style gangs. But after I finished that series, I returned to more policy-type stories mm-hmm. and coverage, mm-hmm. and that taste of doing that kind of work stuck with me and ultimately led me back into a full-time beat in the city of Newark itself.
You know, when I grew up in the mid-70s in the Midwest, my friends were only interested in Dr. J and Franco Harris. So I would think that baseball is probably just about one of the hardest sports to sell to kids like me, I mean kids like that, in the inner city.
Absolutely, and that's one of the underlying themes of A Chance to Win, is that baseball has been, I'm sure you're aware, deep decline in the inner cities. And there are many reasons for that, and I think that most kids are like yourself, even back in the 70s, that they're attracted mostly to football and basketball. And there are many different reasons for that. Marketing is one of them, and it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy where many of the people who go on to excel in sports choose the more lucrative sports, and that's basketball and football. And then ultimately, kids in the inner city, especially African-American kids, don't see anybody who looks like them in Major League Baseball. And it's a cycle that has now led to a steep decline in the number of African-Americans who are in Major League Baseball. And I think that that's part of what you see in the background going on in this story, A Chance to Win. And it's part of the difficulty that Rodney, the main character, has in developing and building this team, is that kids just don't play. He's starting with people who have never even picked up a glove, let alone own one.
When you started writing this book, I'm just curious to know the differences you have seen in New Jersey, which is not exactly one of the wealthiest states in the country, since before the crash versus afterwards. I mean, it doesn't portray itself as a very wealthy state, and I can't imagine the economy is doing it any favors. What have you seen in terms of how people are living the kind of lives like Mr. Mason have been going through?
Well, New Jersey is actually a study in extreme contrasts. Newark has been one of the most hard-hit areas of the country by the not only the economic crisis, but more specifically the foreclosure crisis. And even more specifically, the South Ward, where this book takes place, has had an inordinately high proportion of people who have lost their homes. That's one example of how the economic crisis impacts inner cities on a disproportionate level. But New Jersey, as a whole, is a relatively wealthy state, and just a few